Feels like in the time we've been on this retreat, we've gone from the end of summer to the beginning of winter or something, no? Like there's been this change. Now it's for real. We've turned the corner and it's actually getting cold. It can be so fascinating to watch changes in seasons and watch changes in ourself in such a short time. Everything that may have happened, everything we may have been through on a retreat, like a whole journey, like a whole spring, summer, autumn, winter. So I'm going to share some poems, some stories, some Dhamma on this subject of form and formless, how they come together. Because the last time I gave a talk was more on the non-self, and then how that formless non-self comes together with the form. It's quite a dance that maybe it will take all our lives to, all of our lives, all put together to really understand that in our hearts, not just in our minds, but in our lives and in our hearts, that deep understanding, you know, that you can get on when you have time for meditation like this. Where your understanding goes all the way through into your heart. It's a very different understanding from reading books, and which is like preparing the earth almost, reading the books. Preparing the earth to plant a garden or something. And then actually the growing happens here in the heart. So I haven't started yet what I plan to speak about, so maybe I should start with that. This is a poem by George Eliot. Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words, but to pour them all out, chaff and grain together, knowing that a faithful hand will take them and sift them, keep what is worth keeping, and then, with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. Do you know this word, chaff? It's like, It's that. So it's like what's left, you know, around the seed of rice or wheat or whatever. The stuff we don't need normally. Unless we're stuffing Dharma cushions. Shall I read it again? Yeah? Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person. Having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words, but to pour them all out, chaff and grain together, knowing that a faithful hand will take them, sift them, keep what is worth keeping, and then, with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. So there was a man, this is in the Depression time in America, around 1928-29, when there was nothing left and no work. People had run out of petrol and they just left their cars and started walking to look for work. So times were hard. And there were many people who just became hobos. They became like tramps, living on the road, sleeping under trees, taking trains a lot, you know, the merchandise trains for free, jumping the trains. It was the whole culture of people who had nothing left. And those people would go to villages or towns and knock on doors and say, do you have any spare food, you know, or something to drink? Or and the hobos even had a kind of sign language to say what, if a town was friendly or not, you know, like a triangle made from sticks or some pebbles, or here it's good to ask for water. So there's a man arriving, a hobo, arriving on a hot day, hot dusty day into a small town. It's so hot and he's walked so far. And he goes to a first door. And just the curtain twitches and closes abruptly. And so he goes to the other side of the street and he knocks on the door. And somebody opens the door and says, go away, slams the door. And so he goes to a third house and knocks on the door. And a voice says, wait, wait, I'm coming. And a little old lady comes and says, what do you want? What can I do for you? And he said, would you give me a glass of water? And she says, yes, come in, come in. And gets him, you know, has him sitting at the table in the kitchen and gives him a glass of water. And he said, oh, thank you very much. I really needed that. And then he says to her, do you have a soup stone, a magic soup stone? And she says, no, what's that? And he says, I'll get you one. I saw one up the road. I'll go and get you one. And he goes out and he walks up the road. Beside the track, there's a nice, round, quite nice-looking stone. And he comes back and he says, this is a magic soup stone. And do you have any onions? And she says, yes, I do. He said, oh, with this magic soup stone, you can make an amazing soup. A few onions, they chop them up together. A few carrots, they peel them together, talking about different ways of peeling carrots, having glasses of water to quench their thirst. Then he says, do you have some spices, some herbs, a bit of thyme, a bit of rosemary maybe? And they keep putting that in, some water into the soup. Do you have a chicken? They go out the back, chicken, pluck the chicken, put the chicken in. All this time they're making friends, they're getting to know each other. Eventually the magic soup is cooked and they both eat that soup delightfully. And the sun is starting to set and they feel like good old friends over this lovely soup. And he says, you can keep the stone if you want. And he leaves it with her and they part, promising to keep in touch. And him promising to come back. And he disappears into the night. And he is a bit cheeky, it's true. He's a little bit devious, hey? But maybe there's a lot to it, the magic soup stone, I don't know. Depends how much you believe in magic, but what comes to my mind with this story is how good he was at connecting, actually. Because she was quite old, quite lonely, this old lady, actually. So she was really, really happy to have someone come by and have a new friend, you know. And he had the skill and the knack to connect with her, even though he could have been perceived as a dangerous person. You know, a tramp on the road, you know, homeless, going into the house of an old lady. You know, nowadays you've got webcams and all sorts of paranoias. And yet there was an opening between them. And so it can bring this question of, what's your soupstone? What's your magic soupstone? Not to find that now, to answer it immediately or anything, but as a question to carry with you, what's your magic soupstone? How do you connect with people? How do you connect with life, with where you live, with your surroundings, with nature? How do you feel that connection, that connectivity of being here, of belonging here? That's something to be contemplated. What's my magic soupstone? To come into that belonging feeling. How to be living here in the lives we have. How to stand in our place, you know, without what I was speaking about the other day, the non-becoming, you know, the disappearing. When we disappear out of our lives sometimes because it's a bit too much to deal with, can't quite find the strength. So what are those lubricants to bring us in? You know, to bring us into this life. So we're not disappearing out of our own life. And going, no, I'm here, this is me. This is me, this is who I am, you know. Like Suba, the one who plucked her eye out, you know. She had that integrity of standing in her place and saying, no, I am this, and I'm good in what I am, and there's nothing you can do to waver me. She stood comfortably in her belonging, in her choices, in where she was at. And of course, sometimes it's easier to not do that, and sometimes it's really necessary to move on and go, ooh, no, I need to make other choices and stuff. Because you're not in the right place. It's not all the time that you are there, you know. But those feelings that a lot of us are battling with, those feelings of not being good enough. You know, that unworthy thing that we all get by moments. We get kind of tripped up by those feelings of not belonging, of not being part of the club, you know. And it can be interesting avenues to discover our tendency, our moments of slipping towards those feelings, and to see how it is in those moments, to be awake in those moments, because we're like contextual, you know. We are part of our context, you know. It's like we are influenced by our environment, and we influence our environment. We're interconnected in that way. We're not just individual parts in a world that has its own way of being, that doesn't, where we're not influencing it at all. our way of seeing the world is part of creating that world, and vice versa, you know. And it's not always obvious that, it's not always clear how contextual it is, how we are. We are because of the context around us, and vice versa, you know. Like you could say, like a brilliant concerto pianist isn't a brilliant pianist with a really out-of-tune, rough-old piano in a barn with no one there kind of thing, you know? Hey, it doesn't make for the brilliant concerto pianist, but a great pianist with a great big grand piano in the lovely place with the people who've come to listen to the great pianist, you know, it's not the pianist on its own, it's the people and how receptive they are, it's the piano, something between the hands of the pianist and the piano itself. See what I mean? It's that interconnectedness that makes that whole event wonderful. It's not one side of it. So how to manifest our form, how to live in this material world. In our most wholesome ways. And actually, I mean, I'm asking these questions, but I've heard a lot of people saying that over this week, their ways of doing that. So a lot of people who've come to speak to me one-to-one, that's what they're doing. They're saying, look, I'm discovering how to manifest in this world as myself, as my real self, you know, to really be me. And there is so much belonging in that when we do actually decide to take our place. And it's funny because when we decide to not, when we're brave enough to stand alone, for example, if not everyone's agreeing with us, to not be doing something just to be liked by people, or to not be saying things just to please, when we're brave enough to stand in our place alone, actually there's a lot of belonging there. There's a lot of strength there when we're ready to do that. And it would seem that would be the lonely bit, you know? When you actually go, no, I'll stand in what I believe in, I'll live the life I want to live, in spite of the pressures of outside, of society, consumerist society or whatever, you know, family pressures, what other people think you should be doing. When you stand in that place, you think that you would be more alone and isolated, but actually you're belonging, you're getting into the roots of your own belonging. So that's worth the tremble of daring to do it. And there's sometimes sometimes we just do feel disconnected and feel like we're not in it, you know? That we're different from other people and we're not, you know, we feel like an outsider sometimes. And I find it very useful to be able to just go, this is a disconnected moment. I'm having a disconnected moment. This is, what's it like? Be curious, you know. What's it like to feel disconnected and a bit isolated? Or, as Sumedha was speaking about, you know, being okay with your aloneness. Being friendly with yourself, like the meditation this morning. That somehow there's always going to be moments of aloneness, of disconnection, of feeling like you're not in the in gang or whatever, and to learn to go, it's okay actually. It's okay. It won't always be like this. I'll just be with it and see what it feels like and relax around that feeling. It's like taking the strength out of it so that it can't frighten anymore. So that you can just be with that. Go with the waves, the different waves there are. So I know this is this is a subject that can bring up quite a lot, because we all feel that vulnerability by moments, not all the time, of course, and people in different variations, you know, of feeling like we don't belong, you know, that we're not part of it. And so I know that talking about this is a bit, phew, it can bring up strong feelings in people in that. But I think it's good now that we have some, we've been sitting meditating for a week, and there's probably enough love in this room for us to be able to feel into this subject a little bit, to be a bit receptive to it. And like all our talks, you know, what's not helpful, what's too much for now, it's okay. Just let it pass, you know. And what's helpful, you can try it out, you know, not just take it, but actually just experiment yourself with these questions. Because it does take some openness to really give ourselves to life, to give ourselves into life. Especially if that's not the habit, not what we've been doing. We've been doing something else, maybe running away or hiding a bit or insulating ourselves, you know. Sometimes that opening of wholeheartedly coming into belonging, into our roots of being here. And it's so variable, the different ways, you know, because it's not all about humans. There can be a lot of belonging in nature. I've had some really, really rocky psychological times in my life, emotional breakdown and, you know, this kind of thing, where, I mean, the therapist was good, but the nature was better, you know. And finding myself, I did the craziest of things, but with my partner, I'd have to walk a lot because I was in town, you know, and we'd be walking around the church and she'd be like, it's midnight, walking in the rain around a church because I needed to be outside so much, you know. And then I would go out to the countryside and just be with trees and lakes and sky because it was so healing. And it was March, and we'd be sitting around a fire, and it would be kind of raining and windy, and my friend would go, noon, it's March and it's raining, why do we have to sit outside around a fire? Because I needed to sit around a fire, you know, to reconnect with that hearth, that feeling that you get from sitting around a fire and just looking into the fire, you know, and getting a bit dirty and bit of black on the face, and hearing the trees, you know, that connection that's plugging us back in. And some people it's dancing alone, or ecstatic dancing, or dancing with someone else in a tango class, who knows, you know. We all find different ways, hey, to make that link with our being here. Playing music. So many things. And the willingness to really, turn up for the smooth and the rough and the, you know, when we stop running away and go, okay, I'll be with it, whatever, you know. There's this great woman, Brené Brown, that you can watch her talks on YouTube, her TED Talks, and she talks a lot about the subjects of vulnerability, you know, shame, belonging, all of these subjects. She's really good because she's actually funny. She cracks me up. Do you know her? Yeah, she's so funny. Do you know her? Yeah, everybody knows her. You know her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wants to watch YouTube video or something. TED Talk.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. She's brilliant, though. No? Mm-hmm. Yeah. She says, I have a quote from her here, our capacity for wholeheartedness can never be greater than our willingness to be brokenhearted. Our capacity for wholeheartedness can never be greater than our willingness to be brokenhearted. I know it's a bit of a funny way of saying it, but I think it's almost like, if you're going to be so frightened to live, in case you get brokenhearted that you don't live, you're not really being wholehearted, you know. But when you just go, okay, I will get brokenhearted if I dare to live, if I dare to stand in my place, there's a wholeheartedness there. There's a lot, there's a funny old way that when I first started in Buddhism, in the Tibetan tradition, that they used to describe connecting with others. And that is, you know, because in Tibet there's some really sharp mountains, hey, the Himalayas. So their reference points are often in regard to these mountains. And they would say, you need to come down from your mountain, the self, and go up the other's mountain. So basically to try to stand in the other's shoes, sometimes to stop just looking from your own point of view and try to step into someone's shoes, to understand them as a connecting factor. That empathy, that understanding of other people's suffering is a great fuel for connection. And as Brené Brown puts it, is sympathy is like feeling for you, you know? And empathy is feeling with you. So it's kind of like somebody tells you about their hard time and you go, oh, I'm so sorry for you, you know. It's not the same as going, wow, shit, that's really bad news, you know. It's not the same as being with the trouble that the person is in, you know. And she's got this really funny sketch, Brené Brown, of like when you're in the deep dark hole, you know, you've dropped into the pit. And someone goes, you're right down there. You go, no, I'm depressed, it's terrible, my life's falling apart, wah, wah, wah. Oh, do you want a sandwich? Which reminds me of some people in my family. Unfortunately, it's like, hello, empathy, hello. So it can really feel like a, just to throw this in here, it can really feel like a paradox, you know, these teachings on non-self. And then we're talking about belonging now, you know, and standing in our place. This is a, it feels like a paradox, but they go together actually. Because there's something about, in my experience, and this is not someone else's teaching or Buddhist or anything, but there's something about dropping our defenses, that comes from feeling into non-self, dropping down the armor and the defenses that brings us into that belonging, that brings us into our connectivity with others. That doesn't happen when someone says something to you and you bring up the drawbridge, you go behind the castle walls and you prepare the catapults and the oil and everything, you know. Then connectivity is not really happening from hyper-defensiveness, you know. So that's that same thing coming down from your mountain, you know. And it often feels like to come into our place and stand alone in our strength, that we do need to defend. And that's the difficult paradox, isn't it? That need to make our boundaries, to be really clear about our boundaries, which we often do need to do. Where do we need to say, no, no, you can't do that? Where do we need to be firm with people without being, you know, without getting the catapult out and the hot oil and everything. And drawing up the drawbridge and shutting the big gates, you know, without super defensive going on of the self, of me, I'm right, certain, I know best, you know. It's a bit of a nebulous, this, how these two fit together. It's a bit difficult to find the exact words, actually. But I'm trying. So yeah, it's how to be here as I am. Here I am. And here as I am, and not taking seriously our sense of self at the same time. And feeling our strengths. Without needing a huge amount of armor. To be strong without armor. And I feel like for me this has been a lifelong learning, a lifelong work, really. As I grew up, transgender, you know, and I see nowadays that there's a lot of a lot more help and understanding for children who were born going, well, you know, I'm not the gender you're telling me I am, you know, I don't feel like what I'm being told I am. There's a lot more help nowadays, and even in schools and stuff, there's a lot more support. But when I was a child, people didn't know the word. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what are you? Somebody even said, once whispered loudly, but what is it? You know? And so I went alone into nature a lot. And I never ate in the canteen, you know? I always had my picnic. And I always found a place that I could go at school and be alone under a tree. And so I spent a lot of time alone, but I found belonging And I found a place of strength with the trees and being in nature. So they were my support group. They were there for me. Or it, nature, was there for me. So that thinking that the conventional places of belonging, sometimes they're not there, but there are other unconventional places. And it's a question of tapping into that and finding those, you know. And they are. They are there for all of us. Different shapes and flavors and tastes. And I know this is a subject that can make us shake a bit. It's not so easy, just Dharma in a in a little Dharma pill, wrapped up easy. Because it touches all of our vulnerability, this subject. So we can have big ideas about non-self and stuff, but, you know, the vulnerability of that, sometimes feelings of not being part of the club or something is, they're strong in us, you know. So, to take them on and feel our roots that go so way back, that are always here, our roots in the intrinsic love there is there, available. We can find in many things, in many parts, unexpected places, hey. That I've been hearing you all tell me about in the one-to-ones, actually. Those places where you find it. So I feel lucky to hear that. That people do find it. They do find their unconventional way in, to feel in. And it's so often that we think we're not in, and we so often are in, actually. We are belonging. It's a bit of a story sometimes, and to feel that. So this mixing of the non-self and the belonging, the form and the formless, I had this question. When I was leaving the monastery, I was wondering about this. How do we do this, you know? And so I tried to get an appointment with the abbot to ask him this question. Because it was the beginning of really questioning this. And he said to me, well, I'm leaving on this day. And I said, well, I'm leaving too. He said, well, I'll give you 10 minutes. But at that time, I've got to go and I'm going to get the plane to Thailand. And I said, okay, great. I'll be there. And so I'm there waiting for him to have a one-to-one with the abbot, you know, my last chance, because I'm leaving, he's leaving. And I sit down, I do my bowing 3 times like you do, and I ask him my question, and somebody from there shouts at me, hey, Noon, come here. And I said, I'm talking to the abbot, you know. I haven't got very long, I'm talking, Noon, come here. And he said, Ajahn Amaro said, well, you better go see what he wants, you know. And I went over, and it was a co-worker from the monastery, and he was a bit special. We were good friends. And he said, you took my washing out of the washing machine and put yours in. And I said, yeah, but your washing is washed. So what's the problem? He said, you touched my washing. Now I have to wash it again. But actually I'd gone back to the abbot. I'd gone, what are you talking about? I've got a meeting with the abbot. And I'd gone back and started my question again. And he called, no, come back here. I said, no. Oh. And he was like, I have to wash my washing again. And I came back and I said to Ajahn Amaro, so what about my question, you know? How do we deal with the huge, expanded spaciousness that we can have in meditation, where we feel all that warmth and love and ease and daily life, you know? How do we deal with these two things, you know, of having to, you know, make the porridge in the morning or whatever? And he said, I thought that was it, actually, that was your answer. He said, that's it. We can spend the rest of our life doing this dance between the form and the formless. Just with that situation. There you are. Thank you. Bye. And he left. And he didn't say anything more than that. So I'll read a poem just to end this, about form and formless. And the title is Bowing Formally, and it's by Gogen, a Zen master. A snowy heron where the winter grass is unseen hides itself in its own figure. A snowy heron, where the winter grass is unseen, hides itself in its own figure. If anybody wants to share anything or add something into this, you're welcome. Ask a question, or just be quiet. That's okay as well. Yeah.
Have you seen the film, The Life of Dogen?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's great.
Is it?
A lot about that woman you talked about, that contemplative life.
Mm-hmm.
The whole film deals about a lot about that subject. But it's about the life of Dogen, so it's...
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, it's in YouTube.
Okay.
It's a Japanese film.
Thank you. Brilliant.
Subtitles and stuff.
Yeah. Is it called The Life of Dogen?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll be watching that. Cheers. I think just to sort of close this subject, not close it, but to finish now, I think that as a proposition, it's a good idea to look for where we do belong. You know, to look for the links of how we belong. Because if we look for the reasons why we don't belong, I think we'll find them, you know. That can be a bit... It's just not worth it, you know. It's not worth it. So to look for... To turn our attention. And when we feel that habit going back, to how much we don't belong. It's just a habit, you know? It's a habit. I don't need to look for those things and turn the attention towards our connecting. Yeah.
I think there was some great wisdom in that last poem. I'm not really sure if I understood what the wisdom was, so can you explain?
Once more.
Shall I read it once more?
Yeah.
But I mean, the poem basically talks about everything I've just talked about the form and the formless. How we can, you know, we can get into non-self teachings and seeing that everything doesn't exist from its own side. Things don't exist out of context. We're contextual, you know. It's like you come from your context in a way. We don't exist from our own side. And at the same time, we do. At the same time, I have a conventional reality going on, you know. A conventional reality of being a white person with a skinny body, that's this tall, that's had this kind of education, that lives in this place, that's had this journey in life. And we're all walking around with our contexts jacket on, you know? So how we exist but we don't is the dance of the form and the formless, you know? And how much, you know, we can go into non-self and not taking seriously the very strong feelings of identity that can cause suffering, and at the same time to know, you know, to know what our where we're coming from, what our context is, to understand our habits and conditioning, you know. Like, I'm coming from this because this is my culture. So there are cultural habits, you know. And then it's whether we believe in them or not. You know, I find myself, as soon as I go, when I'm in France, I don't feel French. But when I go away from France, I often feel French. In that midday is a good time to eat, you know. And it's important to eat and to have a good break at lunchtime. And yet, it's just a cultural habit. Isn't it? It's not really that I'm French all the way through into my blood. In my bones, I'm molecules, not French. You know? I'm air and there's some solidity, there's some oxygen, there's some energy, there's some liquid, and that's not French. But it's not a graspable subject, you know, with the mind necessarily. It's not so easy to get it mentally. You know, I've been trying to understand this subject for 15 years, and I understand this much, you know, of the vast world of form and formless that's so big. My arms can never reach far enough back, you know. So also to be relaxed around mental understanding, that we don't need to understand everything with our brains, you know. Something in the heart today, and the rest, it will come. In good time, it will all come. Understanding will come in the heart. I read it again. I love this poem. I can read it all day. Bowing formally, a snowy heron, where the winter grass is unseen, hides itself in its own figure. So there's some, because there's snow on the field, there's some hidden grass, there's hiddenness. Not everything is visible, not everything is apparent. And it has a figure, but you can't see it because it's in a snowfield. And it's hiding its own form, disappearing. Thank you very much for your presence and kind attention.